The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, hello, and a very good morning to you. It's 4 minutes past nine, and it is Wednesday, the 17th of July. How are you all keeping? I do hope you're very well indeed. And we look forward to the next 3 hours of your company on the 9 till noon show. The usual mix, the usual busy mix of stuff, as you can imagine. We still have quite a few comments and what have you to get through from yesterday as well. It was such a busy Tuesday. We'll do that as the day wears on. But keep your new ones coming in as well to 086 60 25,000. That's the WhatsApp and text, or give us a call on 07491 25,000. If you prefer to email, and often I see people who sort of want to go into a little bit more detail in a comment or a story, they tend to use email, and it's comments@highlandradio.com, and you can comment, of course, on our social media as well. Okay, let's begin with a look through what's making the newspapers today. We'll start with the Finn Valley Voice and the recent election of a new board for Ballybofane Stranorlar Chamber of Commerce signifies exciting times for all businesses in the Twin Towns and surrounding areas. The chamber has been rebranded as Ballybofane Stranorlar Business Chamber, complete with a new logo and new ethos to become more business orientated while still being involved with all the town events such as Christmas lights, St. Patrick's Day and Halloween, etc. Regular informative breakfast briefings will become the norm to help and guide businesses to become more efficient, compliant and to grow. So we might speak to them down the line, get a sense of what the plans are for the future there. On to the Nationals now. We'll start with the Irish Times. And the CSO's released latest figures, which show our population could pass 7 million by 2057. The Republic's population could swell to over 7 million by 2057, so that's 30-odd years away. This according to new projections from the Central Statistics Office. The agency has mapped several projections for how the state's population might grow between now and 2057 based on various assumptions about inward migration and fertility rates. Now, the reality is that that growth is going to be almost exclusively due to immigration coming in. So they're predicting the population will be 7 million by 2057, and that, for the most part, is going to be people coming into the country. To give you an example, in the last statistics I had available to us in Donegal here, there were 1,290 deaths in 2022, but there were 1,667 births. So whilst that is almost 500 new people born to Donegal, you need a far bigger ratio, really, to look at anything like the population growth that's being predicted there. So the population growth is slowing. People are passing away, obviously, and not enough babies are being born to replace them at a rate that is required for sort of an organic population growth along the lines of what we're talking. So the bottom line is if the population is 7 million by 2057, that is being driven by inward migration. Under a high net migration scenario, which assumes inward migration starts at 75,000 in 2022, increasing incrementally to 45,000 by 2027 and remaining at this level out to 2057, the population grows by 1.8 million, 35%, to 7.01 million. Under the more moderate net migration scenario, which assumes netward migration of 30,000 a year after 2032, the population grows by 1.26 million or 24%. And under a low migration scenario, which assumes net inward migration of 10,000 after 2032, the population is only expected to increase by 549,000 or 10%. But still, even at the lowest level, the population to grow by 10%, and that made up primarily by inward migration. Right, on to the Irish Independent now, and your tax disc on your windscreen is going to be a thing of the past. We did flag this for you last month or the month before, but anyway, new laws will allow Gardaí to share road crash details with local authorities to help identify what factors contribute to them. The move follows the revelation that local authority engineers have had no information on the circumstances of crashes for 6 years because of concerns that sharing details could breach data protection regulation. The Roads Bill which the government aims to enact in the autumn, will allow for details to be shared while protecting the personal privacy of victims who have rights under GDPR law. Now, why did it take this long for them to figure out that we can still give the information to local authorities that help shapes future road improvements, but will withhold names and then GDPR won't be an issue? Well, anyway, the number of deaths on Irish roads continues to grow and authorities scramble to understand what's happening. Up to yesterday morning, 104 people had died in 97 instances, an increase on the 85 instances and 89 fatalities in the same period last year. But also, as I mentioned, tax discs are also going to be done away with under this new law, which will tidy up the windscreen. And you know what? They can be quite, they can obstruct your line of vision as well. The Irish Daily Star this morning, just 158 new social homes were built in the first 3 months of 2024. The government's target was 9,300, but just 158 delivered. The Department of Housing said a further 330 social homes were bought in the first quarter, while 232 were leased. However, the department said most of the properties it is constructing will be delivered in the final months of the year. Housing Minister Dara O'Brien said it is clear to see that record investment under housing is bearing fruit in a robust delivery pipeline, and a strong momentum is growing. I beg your pardon. I'm getting a scam call on my watch, you see. I'm almost half tempted to answer it on air just to see what they say. But anyway, I won't. It's kind of frustrating. The phone's ringing on silent. But anyway, Dara O'Brien went on to say, it's very apparent that the ability of local authorities to build social housing on their own land in alignment with the Housing Delivery Action Plan is pivotal to achieving cost-effective delivery at the scale required under current and future projections. We are working with them to ensure they can deliver on their full potential, he said. Another night of at least standoffs between people in Coolock and the Gardaí. See these images of people with balaclavas on and chucking stuff at police in the Gardaí. I know they might say, well, the Gardaí are being heavy-handed, but it's crazy to see. And so many young people that I don't really think are invested in the whole conversation at all. I think maybe there are older people who could maybe show a bit of guidance and say, look, there's another way of doing this. We can make our point without necessarily breaking up stones and rocks and throwing petrol bombs at police or Gardaí. But anyway, Taoiseach Simon Harris yesterday blasted the sheer thuggery at a planned site for asylum seekers in Coolock as locals brace for more violence in the days ahead. Large blocks were placed outside the former Crown Paints factory overnight after Monday's mayhem. More than 100 people, many of them were wearing masks. They gathered outside the site on Dublin's Malahide Road for another round of protests yesterday. And last night, the public order unit was deployed again with around 70 protesters moved on. Gardaí sources told the paper the orchestrators of Monday's violence had held meetings to coordinate their actions. And also, it's just there's a real change in the tone of things in this country. Stuff you didn't see before happening now, like there was a mini tented village came yesterday, and locals saying, you know, like making direct threats, saying, you know, the police can't or the Gardaí can't protect you all the time, and so on and so forth. It's just the whole language and rhetoric is getting very it's getting very dark in tone now. The Irish Mirror tells us that an emergency security operation was mounted after a far right plot to murder Leo Varadkar was uncovered. The former Taoiseach had his armed security detail reinstated after Garda intelligence learned a gang planned to use an ex-soldier from an elite foreign military outfit to shoot him. One source said the plot was real and it was advanced. It comes as Mr. Varadkar, who also served as Taoiseach, confirmed last night that he won't be standing in the next general election. I just presumed that. I thought that was a given. And finally, just for those of you who watch Strictly Come Dancing, I know there's quite a big following of it in this country. It's at this time of the year that Strictly Casting Bosses normally puts the finishing touches to their star-studded lineup. But after months of being bombarded with calls from agents begging for their clients to be given a place in the Saturday Night Favourite, Stefania Alexander, the show's long-serving booker, has usually signed up at least 6 or 7 celebrities whose names inevitably find their way into the public domain. This time round, though, however, it's been quite a struggle, despite it being Strictly's 20th anniversary year. Insiders at the BBC say they're having problems recruiting females in particular, especially high-profile ones, a first in its rich history, and this is based on some controversy as it relates to the male professional dancers and a couple of allegations of bullying and the mistreating of their dancing partners and what have you. So there you go. We're joined in studio by our next guest on the programme. It's Liam Dwyer, the Irish Red Cross's Migration Advisor. Thank you so much for joining us, Liam.
Good to be here, Greg. Thank you.
And we're talking after a meeting last night. The Red Cross, the Irish Red Cross, hosted a community consultation in a bid to decide how the remainder of the Chríslach Fund should be spent. But do you want to sort of give us a quick overview up until now, the role of the Irish Red Cross, Liam, and your teams following the tragic events in Chríslach?
Well, I suppose from the very beginning, our members in Donegal would have made contact straight away with people who were impacted and suffered so badly because of that explosion. And particularly, I suppose, when monies were coming into the Red Cross, we were able to have our members on the ground who were able to call to people to be there, particularly people going through so much trauma, who needed support, immediate emergency support. And we were able to provide that early on. I think after that, when we realised the amount of money that was there as well, we put together a plan with the community that we would have a member of our team, a professional member of our team in Chríslach at least one day a week. And we completed that for about 6 to 8 months. And again, that person was liaising with the community, with the families of the bereaved in particular, people who are injured, just getting a sense of what the needs were. And also then a sense of what to do with the money. So the money amounted to, or has amounted to, in the end, 1.9 million. So it was about ensuring that that money was distributed appropriately and meeting the real needs of people impacted in Chríslach.
And that's a challenge, isn't it? I mean, you know, obviously there are those that were, that very sadly lost their lives and their immediate family, or even wider family for that matter. There were those that were present, there were those that were injured. And then, you know, it goes out in waves then, and you have people maybe that were on the scene or were first responders or whatever it might be. I'm not talking necessarily about the official first responders, but certainly those in the community that just were there and helping out. So it's quite a lot of people, and it's quite complex, I imagine, in working it all out and what's appropriate and what have you.
Yeah, it is complex. And I suppose we were lucky we had someone with good competencies in those areas and was able to liaise not just with the individuals themselves, but also with the statutory agencies, because obviously they were there playing a role to ensure that trauma support was there, that psychological help was there, and financial. And the financial is very important, because ultimately people lost livelihoods, they lost jobs, they lost homes, and they
lost
obviously
the
worst.
To work, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
They did indeed. Yeah. It was a huge issue. So part of the role was to make certain that the real needs were identified. But the community early on made it very, very clear, because from day one we said, look, you know, we will focus on spending the money here in Chríslach and its environs with those who have been impacted. And they were very clear with us. They said, look, bereaved families first. We want you to focus on that. And if there's funds over then, well, then we would be delighted to utilise those funds in the community. And I suppose then the work that we have been doing over the last time has been simply to make certain that the bereaved families were, number one, cared for financially in whatever way possible, and also people who were injured and impacted and lost houses and jobs, etc. And we're at a stage now, I suppose, where we have 144,000 left, which is about 7.5% of the fund. And we need to talk to the community and the families of the bereaved about how that money is
so
to be spent.
How do we find ourselves with 144,000 left over, and the subject of you know, a series of public meetings? Is that the norm in this type of a situation? Is this part of the process of wrapping it up? If you know what I mean, it's like, how do we come to a point where there's 144,000 remaining. Is it a happenstance or is it part of the process?
It was always part of the process. From day one, we said, look, you know, obviously the main focus of the funds were given to assist families, people in need, people impacted, but also the community itself. So the community was clear, we want you to focus on the families of the bereaved first, and then come back to us if there are monies over and we can have a discussion about how those monies should be spent. So that's what we are doing at the moment. And the meeting last night, there were 19 of us there last night from a variety of both the community organisations, individuals, the families themselves of people who are bereaved. And we just discussed the amount of money and the possible usage and the way that money could be used or how people could access it.
And just in terms of the turnout, I mean, were many more people invited? Is that how many you might have expected to attend, or were you disappointed, or what was the reaction?
Well, I mean, look, I suppose we would normally expect somewhere between, you know, 15 and 30 people to attend. So it wasn't an unusual number. Obviously, the more people who are there, the better. What we did to prepare, though, was we made certain that the families of the bereaved received letters from us directly first to say we were coming up and that we would be delighted to meet them individually. Because sometimes
did many take
they
you
have
up
other,
on that?
But no, ironically, Greg. Mm-hmm. And look, that remains absolutely open. The Red Cross is here with
That's
a focus.
That's their prerogative, isn't it?
It is their prerogative. They know the Red Cross is always going to be available over the coming months and years. So if people need us or want to talk to us, we're open to that.
So some of the suggestions that came forward
yes.
last evening, trauma support. What does that look like?
Yeah, the discussion really was around the type of support that people need in these in such a tragic event in a close-knit community. It's a long-term support, so there's immediate support straight away, and people will need counselling or need counselling and receive it. But there are longer-term issues. Some of these issues really only come to people's minds, I suppose, after a year, two, or three years.
Different things and happen at different times.
Exactly.
But is it the role of the Red Cross really to sort of account for that? Would you not expect other agencies, the HSE, for an example, to step in and free up this funding for something else? Do you know what I mean? Especially the fact that we would expect it to be a long-term commitment.
Look, Greg, there's no doubt about that. And I mean, the HSE have a fund set aside and provide services in this area. We're talking about utilising the funds that we have to enhance that and to make that available down at the core level for, you know, for football teams, for social occasions, for, you know, within church communities, you know, within the real community trauma support, and to make certain that that is available. But we would do that, and I think the discussion last night was that we should be doing it with the likes of the Donegal Youth Association, with Foroiga, etc., with the GAA, etc., with the variety
no
of other people involved.
No point starting from scratch.
You
engage with those that are already working in that area.
Precisely,
A Garden of Remembrance, too, because that, I think that's really important, is how, you know, how this is not remembered or marked. I'm not sure of the exact words. But, you know, what is done in that regard going forward? That will, because this would be established and it would be maintained and it will be there for generations, if you know what I mean. So, who would be responsible for the establishment of a Garden of Remembrance, and what role might the Red Cross have in that? I suppose maybe starter funding or something, or what's the feeling?
Yeah, the feeling was that commemorative events or something like a garden to remember people, that they were suggestions that came up. Now, they have come up before, and we had them on the agenda for discussion last night, but it's interesting that the garden concept was very strong. And what we'd like to do at this stage is to firstly, design a website with all of this information on it. Mm-hmm. We'd like to share that in particular with the families of the bereaved. That would be our next move. And once they're good with the layout of this, well, then we're going to put that website up and enable people to to look at what the possibilities for the funding are and the methodology for accessing that funding. And with that in mind, we hope to persuade a couple of people within the local community to take an assessment role, because, you know, you don't want an outside organisation like the Red Cross, you know, making decisions like that. We want to make these are community decisions.
But there comes a point, too, where the Irish Red Cross needs to step back.
Absolutely.
The same as everyone. You know, there comes a point where everyone needs to step back and it's the community that moves forwards.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not to say withdraw any supports, but you know what I mean? There is a time that people maybe want to move on to the next stage of a very long journey for themselves.
Yeah, and there are. There's a community association there, and the community association will, I've no doubt, they were
the
present last night.
They will
take leadership roles within a leadership role within the community, and we will support that.
Yeah. Another meeting in September. So what's the purpose of that?
Well, that's to finalise all of these arrangements, in the sense that we've got a lot to think about after last night. We want to go back now and consult one more time with the families of the bereaved, and then we want to come up with the map, the way we're going to deal with this 144,000, and the website we're going to set up, and looking for that community involvement to take it really from us, because I think that's the critical piece.
And it's a great challenge, because lots of people have lots of different views, all carry equal weight, and it's getting to a point whereby as much as anyone possibly could is trying to do as much as each individual or each group want.
Yeah, and you know, that,
if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, it does. It's complex, and it's complex because you've got the individuals, and people have been hugely traumatized by this awful tragedy, and so it's trying to respect that and trying to enable people to move in as much as they can to move on from that. And to do that both for the individuals and to do that at a community level. Mm-hmm. Because really we want to try and focus now on the community and the needs of the community. We want to do that respectfully.
And I know you want to speak to everybody, right? So anyone in the community or anyone who is affected by this or who is bereaved, sometimes you can't reach everyone even with the letters or whatever it might be. So what is your message for the community? They can identify themselves if they are, part of this, just in terms of engagement between now and September, or making so that they feel their voices are being heard or what have you. So what is your message to them in terms of this process?
Well, it's to contact us. So in other words, the Irish Red Cross is there. We obviously the phone numbers, etc., the contact emails are there. To look for Liam O'Dwyer, I'm the contact person, or Niall Keane, my colleague, and we would be delighted to talk to anybody who has ideas about this, about ways forward. And then we will be back in September to have that further discussion with the community, I hope, bring matters then to a head in terms of a plan as to how to utilise the
and at
the
that
funds.
Point, without not in terms of abandoning anyone or any community, but the Red Cross step away at that point, would you hope towards the end of this year?
Greg, look, from our point of view, we're delighted to have this investment, to be quite frank with you, in Donegal. The Red Cross in Donegal is very strong in what it does, and our commitment is to be there. But in terms of this process, we're keen to move the process over to the community.
Yeah.
So the community takes ownership and is not dependent in any way on the Red Cross.
I call it once, a couple of callers, do the Red Cross get paid for the work? I've just asked that.
No is the answer to that. I suppose that's why we presented the accounts last night to the community. And we've made it quite clear that the Red Cross has not taken what would be a normal percentage. And indeed, it has had to cover the costs of the salaries of the people who've been involved out of its own funds,
that's
not out of this fund.
Okay, it's good to clarify that. So, I mean, obviously people have to get paid, but it's the Red Cross that have paid that out of their funds, and nothing in that regard has been taken from the very generous donations from the public. Okay, Liam, Do you need to signpost people where the contact details are, or do you think they're broad, widely available out there in the community? Or
I think they're available. I think if people just look up the website of the Irish Red Cross or the phone numbers and make contact with us, we'd be delighted to talk with them. And prior to the meetings, I was delighted to get a number of emails and a number of telephone conversations with people locally prior to the meeting, which was great.
Okay, useful indeed. All right, Liam O'Dwyer, unless there's anything else you think needs to be added?
Nope, that's okay. Great. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you very much for calling in. That's Liam O'Dwyer, the Irish Red Cross Migration Advisor. A listener says, anyone else have bother with young people throwing eggs at their house last night? Three houses in Ardmore Manor hit with eggs. Young people seen running, then getting into a car, which then went on up the road towards Iskeheen. Anyone else out there get... I mean, it's a silly thing to be honest. It makes a mess. It's stupid. And it can feel quite personal as well. Anyone else have their house targeted by eggs last night? Hi, Greg. If you want to understand the underlying reason as to what is going on in Coolock, then look to what the Independent Central Statistics Office published yesterday. Immigration will drive up the Irish population to over 7 million by 2057. That's an increase of 2 million, 40%. Dublin is trying to force massive demographic change on the Irish so as to drive up rents for the benefit of the landlords and to keep wages low to benefit foreign corporations. This is totally unprecedented in human history, purposely designed to destroy Irish culture, history, language and any sense of Irishness. Okay, that's to presume that people coming here don't feel Irish or won't learn the language or what have you. I take what you're saying, but what's the alternative? So Irish people, by their own decision, by their own choice, are not... reproducing at the level that is required to sustain the state. And that's just the bottom line. Thankfully, people are living longer. People are living into older age, but people require care and support. We have to fund pensions. And we are, the workforce in this country is shrinking. So the amount of people that are actually working and able to contribute is shrinking. So by 2057, if there is no inward migration, and I'm not saying this is the solution, I'm asking you what the solution is. We have a workforce that is shrunk significantly, and we have an older population which has grown significantly. I didn't write down the older population figure growth between now and then. So what's the alternative? So we can't force people to have babies, and we need a population to keep the country going, to work, to provide, to pay tax, and to support and care for our older generation. So what is your solution? I'm not saying migration is the solution, but we need, something's going to have to happen. But this, because we're seeing it in other countries, the rate of births is slowing down. The rate of deaths is going to exceed births at some point. So what do we do? What's the solution there? Because, as I say, they're already struggling to get people to work in certain jobs. And people are, as I say, aging and living longer. And that's fantastic. What is the plan? I got home from Letterkenny Hospital last night. I had a very good experience. I was in for 8 days. I was admitted early Sunday morning to the ED department last week. I had a scan and they noticed something. I had a procedure the next day. While waiting, I went downhill and ended up in the ICU. They had to get my blood pressure up. I was then in surgical ward to recover. I had sepsis. It affected my organs, which was very nasty. I'm on the road to recovery for 2 weeks. I've nothing but praise for the staff in Letterkenny University Hospital. I want people to know how serious sepsis is. Indeed, and it is really, really serious. And you're being asked, and you would have heard ads running on radio and in the newspapers encourage people to, if they suspect they have sepsis, to sort of say, it, is it sepsis? Could it be sepsis? Because you really need to get in there quickly. Listen, listener, I'm delighted you got the care that you needed, and I'm very pleased that you are on the road to recovery. I don't know what goes through people's heads, but 11 pups were found dumped in Carrigart this week by a passerby. Six were already dead. Rescue charity Animals in Need Donegal have publicly condemned the attack. I think we all can. So 11 pups in total, six were dead. Dieta McMullen is a volunteer with Animals in Need and joins us now. Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, that's no problem at all.
You'd wonder, wouldn't you, you know, if you're thinking of the process of what someone has to do, and I'm not going to upset people, and especially young ones who are off school, but they were loaded into a bag effectively and just dumped, weren't they?
They were put into a bag with a big stone and dumped up in gorse bushes, you know, just up very deserted area. It was just by pure luck that a young woman without walking her dog came across the bag with the pups in, like...
So do you think the motivation of the person responsible was that they would just perish up there in this bag and no one would discover them?
That's the only conclusion to draw, really. It was pure luck that they were found. You know, nobody would tend to come. It was a very deserted area. Mm. Nobody would be coming there. Like, there really was no excuse for the like of this. And we would be very concerned about the mother dog.
Yeah.
Because out there somewhere there is a mother dog as well that's missing pups. And
I don't need to paint the picture, but you know, these are animals with feelings and some understanding of the surroundings, of course.
Absolutely.
For them to perish in the way they did, you know, slow agonizing death, as I say. And I suppose you have to paint that picture for people to realize that some people are capable of this.
Excuse me. Absolutely. Like, I mean, it is inexcusable. I mean, you imagine the fear, you know, I mean, they basically starve to death. Like, you know, there's no way of putting it that makes it any bit okay. Look, there's so much, it's very easy to prevent a dog from having pups. Like, you know, it's a quick operation. You know, there are charities out there like ourselves. There's other charities, Dog Trust as well, that helps with neutering costs. So, I mean, there's no excuse to let a dog go through this, have the pups, I mean, the distress on the dog as well. I mean, she could be facing complications now after, like mastitis or anything like that. So, you know, it would be imperative to find the mother and make sure that she is getting the care that she needs as well, never mind the pups. Now, we have the 5 pups here that came to us alive. 3 of them were already showing signs of their bodies shutting down. Mm-hmm. Now, thankfully, only one of them passed. So we have 4 pups that seems very healthy at the moment anyway. And, you know, they're just getting used to the bottle. Like, I mean, it's a big change for them too, like for them to suddenly be here and not knowing what's going on and having to get used to taking the bottle and all. But we're getting there and they're getting well used to it now, like, which is fantastic.
Yeah. What... I mean, obviously, this is a criminal act. It's a cruelty act. Any information?
Yes, abandonment is a cruelty act.
Anyone who has any information about who might be responsible for this needs to take that information to the Gardaí.
Yes, it has been reported both to the Gardaí and the ISPCA is following it up as well.
Yeah, but anyone who observed anything?
Anybody that has anything, like, I mean, usually you would look for dash cam images or anything like that. It wouldn't really be possible out that area. But I'm sure somebody would know, possibly in that area, you know, a dog that looked like she was pregnant recently, you know, and then suddenly is not.
Yeah.
You know, like 11 pups, she would have been fairly big. It is a collie dog, unfortunately, the usual kind of dog that does be around, like, so... There would be a lot of them dogs about the area.
Yeah.
I mean, definitely report it if anybody knows something.
Because this, I mean, if someone is capable of this, you'd have to wonder what else they're capable of. It's horrendous.
Yes, I mean, we keep thinking about, like, what were they thinking? How could they walk away? How could they put them in the bag? How could they walk away? How could they have any peace after that, after doing that? Knowing that they have condemned them to die like that, how can they have any peace at all?
What age do you think the puppies were? We're looking at a picture of the here, lovely wee things.
They're newborn. They're newborn. The umbilical cords were still attached. The wee ones that was passed, like, you know, I mean, they were newborn, like.
Oh, my word.
Definitely. So, I mean, they were basically torn straight off the bum, like.
I know. As you say, what about her?
It's the worry with her, because the pups, the remaining pups, they are getting the care, but is she getting the care that she needs? Because she would be having milk for the pups, which can easily turn to mastitis when there's no pups there. Any other complications? Were all the pups delivered? You know, does she need help? You know, we would just be worried about that, because 11 pups is a lot. She would need a lot of extra feeding as well. Like, how is she doing herself?
Yeah. Someone knows something. I mean, did someone drive to the area? I don't know. I mean, we can't presume, can we?
That's it. It mightn't be a local person. It might just be somebody who had the pups and just drove till they found somewhere they thought was deserted enough. It's hard to know, and you know, you can't even put yourself in their mindset. It's just too dreadful to think of. Like, and I mean, these poor wee innocent ones. Like, you know, it's not right.
So, if anyone if anyone out there, you know, noticed that there was obviously going to be a heavily pregnant dog, a collie dog,
exactly,
presume,
and she shot.
And now all of a sudden, it's not pregnant, and the puppies are gone. 11 of them, a significant number.
There should be warning bells ringing there. Yes, yeah. There should be somebody noticing that.
Okay, and someone had to drive there, presumably. They might not have seen the act of the bag being disposed of, but they certainly may have. They certainly may have seen a car travelling in that direction.
They will notice that. Yeah, they would notice a dog.
So whereabouts in Carrigart did this happen?
Now, I am not very good with pronunciation. Gortnabraid.
Yeah, Gortnabraid.
Is there something called Gortnabraid or something like that? Yeah, that's the area there. Yeah.
All right, anyone in and around Gortnabraid? There's a lot of people out walking and what have you.
There would be a lot of people out walking there, yes.
Okay. Listen, there's a cost involved in the care of these animals.
Yes.
There's a GoFundMe page set up as well for anyone who wants to contribute.
It's not a GoFundMe page, but we have our link up on Facebook. It's I Donate and, PayPal and my charity app we have up there. So there's a way of donating, like, so they're on colostrum here now to start with, and then they go on to normal puppy milk then. And, you know, it'd be all the puppy food and all, like, you know, I mean, we can only think that the mum wouldn't have had the proper nutrition herself, so it's extra important that these get top nutrition.
Yeah. A lot of
now to keep them going.
The wee dubs.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Right. Okay, listen, thanks very much for that. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
It's a shame to be talking in this context. But anyway, thanks very much. Take care.
Okay, thanks very much.
Bye-bye. Devin McMullen there, who's a volunteer with Animals in Need, Donegal. Someone, as I say, I don't want to be too graphic, but someone put 11 puppies in a bag, a rock in the bag, went near Gortnabraid and dumped them. And very sadly, 6 were dead on discovery of further. 1 died. The wee dotes that we're looking at now here, they're doing okay. They're getting the care and attention that they need. But the mother, a big concern is for the mother of the dog, the well-being of the mother. What must she be going through? I know these aren't humans, but still they have feelings and understanding and what have you. I would say if you have any information on that, you know, there's going to be a collie cross, whatever it might be, that was very heavily pregnant, had at least 11 puppies. It's no longer pregnant. Those 11 puppies are gone. Where are they? The person may well be, most likely, I would suggest, probably from outside the area, but not necessarily. And someone knows something. And whoever is responsible for that needs to be held to account, because it's just not right, is it? It's just not right. You might remember we had contacts from people who landed there, and the castle wasn't open for tours, and they said it was because of staffing shortages and they were working on it. But I've been told that it has returned to being open to the public 7 days a week. Fair play, good stuff. A caller says there's a shortage of labour in Ireland. Everyone's in Australia as there is nothing for them. I get what you're saying. Far too many young people, those that have been forced to go and haven't gone by choice, are in different countries. The numbers are not anywhere near, if they all come home, the numbers aren't anywhere near where we'd need to be to sustain this country, throughout this century. But I take your point, and I'll read the rest of your message in a second. But I've been joined now by Donal Harkin, who's with us. Good morning, Donal.
Good morning, how are things?
I'm doing fabulous. What about yourself?
Grand, still in bed, no, not long, still a little croaky, but all good.
too much information. No, I'm only messing. Playing with Pride is presented and created by Shout Out volunteer and steering committee member Donal Harkin from BIRT. So talk to us, Playing with Pride, what is it?
So basically, it's a documentary about people who are from the LGBT community and their engagement with sport. It's something that a lot of people from the community have kind of found something they were pushed out of very young, or they weren't necessarily welcoming. And that was basically what the documentary looks at: what's changed and what still needs to change.
Yeah, and you know, before we talk about those that perhaps are you know, out and taking part in sport, there is something going on, because you know, I can't think of a single boxer or a single I'm not saying there aren't, by the way, but a GEA player or a soccer player who is openly gay and playing the sports. As I say, I know there are there, but there's an awful lot of them that are gay, for an example, and don't feel that they can be open about it. It's up to them, of course, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, of course. Like, firstly, it is a private thing. If someone doesn't want to share that, that's fine. But there obviously is this issue where being maybe openly gay in sport or openly LGBT is a bit of an issue, especially when it comes to men as well. I suppose one thing I heard from one person who took part in the documentary was that sport may be the kind of last bastion of where maybe slightly homophobic attitudes are not permitted, but maybe tolerated. So there is an issue here where maybe in a macho kind of culture, which sport is, that, you know, if you are gay or LGBT, it's just something that's not really spoken about or not really welcome. So there definitely is a reason there, for some reason, for people not to come out. And there's been a rise recently as well of like LGBT specific teams in Ireland, like a gay GA team, a gay football team, a gay rugby team, because people don't feel welcome. So there is obviously some issue here. That's what the documentary explores. Why is this the case? What do we need to change? And why is the people feel that they can't be themselves in this big part of Irish culture, which a lot of people are involved in?
Yeah, I think, though, it's getting ever more complicated, though, to find a solution if it's LGBTQ+. Because, you know, they're like, say, for instance, in terms of the trans community changing spaces, women born men playing in women's sport. I think when it's all grouped together, it's very complicated to come up with a path forward. I would say I wouldn't like to be doing the navigation of that. Do you get where I'm coming from?
Yeah, of course. I suppose, you know, it is one big community, but there are differences. I suppose, like, if you're, let's say, a gay man, you know, what's your struggle coming out as gay? Whereas if you're a trans person, for instance, like, trans women can't play rugby. Now, that's a World Rugby decision that was made. And there is these kind of different issues as well. I suppose the viewpoint of, let's say, myself, the organisation, is that everyone has a right to play sport. And I can understand that some people may have kind of qualms and worries around people playing. But then the day, and we're excluding people from playing sport, which is meant to be an activity to bring people together and to foster a kind of community, why we want to exclude people. Yeah. So I haven't got all the answers myself.
No, neither do I, because there are in there competing rights as well.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I'm not an expert in this at all. I'm just trying to create the conversation, but I think that everyone should be able to take part and play. I think when it comes to trans people being involved, I think there's a lot of kind of hype and kind of like panic, or like, oh, they're going to come in and play all these sports, when really and truly you're talking about a very small amount of people. And I think, you know, excluding them from playing at all isn't fair. And I would like to see policies come in place which are welcome to everybody. Again, what they look like and what they could be, I don't know. I'm not trans myself, so I'm not going to be able to say, but I think no one should be excluded from sport, no matter what their sexuality or gender identity is.
Talk to me about the documentary. It's an online documentary. Is it available now? By the way, we'll remind people towards the end, but it is available now, Donald.
Yeah. You can just Google Playing With Pride, shout out, and it'll come up. Basically, I speak to people from the community who are involved in LGBT teams, and we talk about, you know, why maybe they fell off being involved in sport when they were younger, then how they came involved again in sport as they were older. I speak to people from the trans community around their opinions and struggles on sport and their community. And then I speak to Jack Dunn, who was the first professional Irish rugby player to come out as bisexual a few years ago. So it's just looking at what's happened, what still needs to change. And people have different views and different opinions. And I think it's all about creating that conversation and seeing, you know, let's address this and make sport available for everybody and not something where anyone feels excluded from.
Yeah. And it's been described as the last frontier for inclusion.
Yeah, I do believe in that as well. Like, I suppose a lot of people have said to me, if the goal is total inclusivity and inclusion, why are these LGBT-specific teams like a gay GA team, a gay football team, a gay rugby team? But I was like, they're obviously being created for a reason, because people don't feel welcome. The reason I wanted to do a documentary was growing up in rural Donegal, sport was very important. And I was put into various sports from a very early age by my parents, who really wanted me to be sporty. And this is back when I was very young and I didn't know I was gay, but I was different. And, you know, there were comments made to me that you're not a man enough, you're not, you know, enough of a tough guy to be here. And a lot of people who are LGBT kind of heard that as well. So they were pushed out of sport from an early age. Mm-hmm. And then by the time they became out and they were older, they realised they didn't feel welcome. And that kind of created a bit of an aversion to sport. Mm. So that's something I would like to see never happen again for anybody, because whatever you're like or whatever your background, you should feel welcome in sport. So there is an issue there. That's why the teams are there. But I think we want to try and get to a stage where it doesn't matter what your sexuality or gender identity is, that you can participate in sport. And if you want to be involved in an LGBT-specific team, that's fine. But also if you want to join your local team, you should be able to without any qualms.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously when you speak to a wide range of people, the stories are going to vary from, you know, poignant, difficult watches potentially to, you know, happy stories as well and what it means for them. So obviously you want to, with the viewer, grow an understanding. And any other sort of, what else do you want to evoke in those watching this? What do you want the viewer to come away with if you feel your work is done, if you know what I'm saying?
It's a good question, actually. What do I want the viewers to come away with? I suppose a lot of the time, the documentary kind of focuses on, you know, organizations and like what they need to, like what does the GAA need to do? What does the IRF need to do? What does the FEI need to do? I suppose for the ordinary viewer, I suppose I want them to think that, like, you know, maybe the very kind of strict ideas they have of, like, you know, only certain people should be involved in sport. I would think them like to change and say, hold on, if sport is for everybody, why would we want to exclude anybody? And also as well, I suppose it's if they have people involved in sport, whether it's their own children, it's about maybe fostering an accepting attitude with them as well. Because at the end of the day, LGBT inclusion is everywhere and it needs to start in the home and the school. And it's positive conversations around if someone is gay or whatever, that's fine. And if you are yourself, it's okay. So whether that's in any environment, you know, fostering that inclusivity and that acceptance at home and anywhere is really important and ensures that every aspect of Irish culture is welcome.
Yeah, and I think it's really important and has never been more important that regardless of whatever a person's opinions end up being, is that they form it themselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know. And the only way you do that is even if you think you it wouldn't be of interest to you or it's not relevant to you, is to actually, you know, this whole do your own research thing, right? We all need to do that. We have to make our own opinions. We can't just rely on a trusted other to formulate what we think. Okay, so search out if you wish. It's available on a number of platforms. YouTube's probably going to be the handiest, of course, but just Google Playing with Pride. And it's from Bert Donal Harkin, who's a volunteer and steering committee member with Shout Out. Playing with Pride, it's a documentary that's available right now online. Listen, thanks very much for that. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for having me on.
Bye-bye, Donal. Thanks very much indeed. That was Donal Harkin there. You're tuned to the 9 till noon show here in Highland Radio. After 10, it's that time of year again. The Mary from Dunlow Festival is nearly upon us. We're going to be speaking to Pat Nora and Gavin, the two men behind it, part of the team behind it, of course, I'm sure they would say. And so much more besides. That's all coming up between now and 12.